To your questions. In a few minutes, we'll be inviting you to call to suggest, as Senator Spector's constituents, how you think he can best represent Pennsylvania's interests and our national interests. Arlen Spector was born and grew up in Kansas. After graduating from Yale Law School, he moved to Philadelphia in the mid-1950s, where he joined the law firm Deckert, Price & Rhodes. He became an assistant district attorney in 1959. In 1964, he served as the assistant counsel to the Warren Commission and became known for his work developing the single bullet theory. He was elected district attorney of Philadelphia in 1965, re-elected in 1969. He was defeated in the 1967 Philadelphia mayoral election, and in his 1973 campaign for Philadelphia DA, he lost two Republican primary races in 76 for U.S. Senate, 78 for Pennsylvania governor. He has just begun his six-year term in the U.S. Senate, which he was elected to in November. He will serve on the Senate Appropriations Committee and the Judiciary Committee. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
In an article called Thunder on the Right, predominantly about Jesse Helms this Sunday in the New York Times, you were mentioned as being a moderate Republican. And I wonder if you would place yourself in the middle of the Republican Party as you were placed in that article.
Terry, I think that the words like moderate or any other categories are very misleading often, and I think that it doesn't advance any causes to use labels. And that's why I'm pleased to be on your program, pleased to respond to any questions specifically with my ideas as to what ought to be done. But I usually use the old joke about the bikini, that it conceals more than it reveals, and I think that's the way labels are. And I frankly prefer not to get involved in any labels. The article about Jesse Helms was an interesting one. It ran about 16 pages, and I drew half a line, so I wasn't too prominently mentioned, happily.
Before we get to your stand on some specific issues that our listeners will be discussing and that I want to discuss with you, I'd like you to just set out for us what you consider to be your agenda for the next 6 years, what some of your priorities are as a senator from Pennsylvania.
Well, I'd be glad to respond to that in terms of what I consider to be the current matters of great concern. I do not think it is possible to have a six-year agenda at the moment. I have what I consider to be the key issues at the moment, and I think the key issue is the problem of inflation, which is really ravaging our society. It has caused tremendous havoc with the elderly who can't live on fixed incomes, and with the young who can't afford to buy houses, with tremendous interest rates, so that it is impossible to buy dwellings, and it is possible for business people to go out, small business people, and have loans. And I think that the idea of getting inflation in tow is the most important item of the day. And I believe that there are going to have to be cuts in the budget. And as a senator from Pennsylvania who has a constituency of the poor and the needy in many, many quarters, I'm going to be watching very closely, as best I can, to see to it that whatever cuts are made are not made among those who really need the so-called safety net, so that as the time goes forward, that is very high on my agenda. I am a member of a number of key committees. I think I was fortunate in committee assignments. I was assigned to the Appropriations Committee, and I might add that when I say assigned, I really mean that it goes by seniority, and I was fortunate to get it because I do not have very much seniority at the start of a senatorial career. But the subcommittees I'm on there are Foreign Operations, which deals with the important issues of aid to foreign governments, including Israel, which is a big issue. I'm on the HUD subcommittee, which deals with the problems of housing. I'm on the Committee for Health and Human Services, which has very widespread ramifications. Then I'm also on the Labor subcommittee. And then for a full committee assignment, in addition to Appropriations and Veterans Affairs, I'm on the Judiciary Committee, where we'll be considering some of the very key issues on constitutional amendments, on busing, on many items very important for civil liberties, and I think that the issue of civil liberties has to be very zealously guarded in 1981 and beyond.
One of the ways of trying to keep down the inflation that has been suggested in the new administration is to cut back on federal funds provided for urban transportation, mass transportation. Many people in Philadelphia feel that if federal funds are cut back for mass transportation here, that it will be a very drastic and negative effects on the city. What are your opinions on federal funding for urban transportation?
I think that mass transit is a line where there ought not to be cuts. I think that others items would come ahead of mass transit on cuts. We have a very We have a SEPTA system in southeastern Pennsylvania, and there are similar systems around the state. Pittsburgh needs help on its mass transit, and so do other areas. And if people cannot get from their homes to their works, they simply can't hold jobs. So that I think that mass transit is an item which urgently requires both federal and state assistance.
Are you hopeful that that assistance will be able to be maintained?
Yes, I am. I do not know yet where the specific cuts are going to be. I've had a preliminary meeting with others from the Senate Appropriations Committee, with David Stockman, and we have some preliminary ideas, but we will not know really very much specification until we hear the President's State of the Union message, which will be a week from tomorrow night.
There is a good chance that many social service programs will be cut back, including food stamps, welfare, other social service systems. Do you think that that is an appropriate place for cuts at this moment?
I am hopeful that the food stamp program will not be cut. I think that there are going to have to be some cuts somewhere, and I'm just going to have to wait and see what the president proposes. And it's very complicated, Terry, to this extent, and I'm asking for inputs from a lot of people. And I'm asking for inputs from the mayors of all the big cities, for example, and other governmental officials. When these proposed cuts come down the pike, we have to analyze and see just exactly what they mean. I think we're going to have to understand in this society that if we are to control inflation, we are going to have budget cuts in federal spending. And I think that is going to be plain. And if the cuts are equitable and they do not really impact on the poorest and the neediest, then I think we're going to have to accept them in a number of quarters. But the specification is just very hard to say. We have a massive federal budget. We have a massive federal budget of $650 billion. It's mind-boggling even to contemplate.
The specifics of where the cuts will be that the new administration makes has not been made clear yet. But do you think that you can support the magnitude of the cuts that have been suggested so far?
I don't know that. They're talking about $40 to $50 billion, and it really depends upon where they come from, and we're going to have to see. And you see, that's why I say, even after there is a proposal for a cut, they're proposing a cut in Program X, you cannot tell precisely what that means until you start to deal with the people who administer those programs. I attended hearings last week of the Labor Committee, and I found out that the Bureau of Labor Statistics wants new research programs on computations of labor statistics, and they are adding $4 million into that program. And we were questioning the people from that department very closely. Now, my feeling is that at a time when there are going to have to be massive budget cuts, that we ought not to be doing new research for labor statistics. And we heard this testimony at some length, and I was simply not persuaded that they should double their budget on research at this particular time. Now, that's one item which I saw. I know that there are some departments which spend an enormous sum of their budget in the last 2 months. For example, the Department of Energy, year before last, spent 41% of its budget in the last 2 months of the year, really just to use it up to justify a bigger budget the next year. And one department spent on September 30th, the last day of the fiscal year, $119,000 for magazines. Well, we know you don't have to do that. And I do believe that there are a lot of areas of waste and fraud, some $5 billion in fraud estimated in one of the major departments. But I do not believe that you can cut $40 to $50 billion on those items alone, and I think that a number of us are going to have to get slimmer with some belt tightening.
One of the main problems being faced now in the state of Pennsylvania is plant closings. Some plants are closing and moving either south or somewhere else altogether. It's been suggested that there be legislation on a local level and perhaps at some future point on a national level that would require plans to give 1 year's notice before closing and to contribute a certain amount of money to the community that they were in, and more benefits and termination pay to the workers. Do you think that it would ever be appropriate on a national level to pass legislation like that?
Well, the difficulty with that legislation is that companies are then going to be reluctant to open up if they are going to face that kind of a limitation on their closing. Behind the problem of inflation, you'd ask me my concern on the agenda, behind the problem of inflation comes the problem of jobs in this state. And I think Pennsylvania has great potential. I am doubtful, going to the heart directly to your question, as to the issue of imposing requirements on companies which open in Pennsylvania. If you did it on the national level so that it was uniform, then companies would not settle in South Carolina in preference to Pennsylvania. But if we do that in Pennsylvania, then it's going to be another reason why companies should settle in the Sun Belt. My own thinking is that we ought to explore in great depth along the first line, not proposals of the sort you mentioned, but to try to stimulate the coal and steel industries and, say, the port of Philadelphia. We have a tremendous resource in this state in coal. We have something like 40 billion tons of coal in Pennsylvania with reserves to satisfy the energy needs of the nation for decades and the tremendous energy for foreign governments. Now, I visited Pier 124 in Philadelphia, which is under renovation to change from 3 million tons of coal export a year to about 10 million tons. And I think that the federal government ought to really be helping on coal development. And I think that can be accomplished consistent with environmental concerns. It's a matter of public bonds which are being used to develop Pier 124. It's a matter of changing utilities from oil to coal with long-term governmentally guaranteed bonds, again, where it's still the private sector. The steel industry needs help in this state. Steel is a tremendously important industry, the number one industry of the state, employing 14% of the workforce. And there has been tremendous foreign dumping, which has victimized United States Steel. And there, I think, again, is an important role for the federal government, one that I've already been working on as U.S. Senator. So that I think the stimulation of jobs, and in our own southeastern Pennsylvania area, we have tremendous black unemployment among young blacks, especially where the unemployment ranges go as high as 47%. And I think we have to focus in on enterprise zones to stimulate job opportunities in the ghetto areas. And those are high priority items. It is the economy. It is inflation and job opportunities.
My guest is U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter. We'll be opening up the phones in just a few minutes. As we're discussing inflation and unemployment and what priorities should be in terms of budget cutbacks, there seems to be a priority now for increasing the military budget. Do you think that the military budget should be increased? And if so, in what areas do you think that money should be spent?
Well, I think that we have to take a look at what Secretary of Defense Weinberger comes up with on cuts and economies. I believe that we do need military capability which has armies, ground forces, which are combat prepared, and our Navy is woefully inadequate. I visited just yesterday the Philadelphia Naval Yard where they're re-outfitting the Saratoga. I'm anxious to see Caspar Weinberger's recommendations on this point. I think we do have to increase our military strength, but there are quite a few studies which suggest that there can be a lot of economies within the Department of Defense. And here again, Terry, it's a matter of balance. We cannot give everything to defense at the expense of social services. There has to be an accommodation among the needs of our society.
What percentage of the military budget do you think should be going towards the development of new weapons, specifically nuclear weapons?
I really could not give you a specific percentage. I'm learning more and more every day. I had quite an educational experience yesterday. You know how big an aircraft carrier is? It's 80,000 tons. It's a little over 1,000 feet, 1,050 feet. It has 2,800 men, 1,400 air units. And one of the jobs that I have, although I'm not on the Armed Services Committee or on the Foreign Affairs Committee, one of the jobs that I have now in my new role is to familiarize myself to a substantial extent with the military picture, and it takes quite a lot of learning.
Do you believe in the viability of limited nuclear war?
I doubt it very much. I think that once you start to deploy nuclear weapons, that you are in a situation which is not compatible with the word limited. You sprang that one on me right out of left field. I've never heard the concept of a limited nuclear war. The use of nuclear weapons, I think, is likely to be very inflammatory. I have read some talk about tactical nuclear weapons, but frankly, I do not know how they would be deployed. But if you start talking about nuclear warfare, I think you're in the range of all-out war.
What kind of military presence do you think the United States should have in Central and Latin America now, specifically in El Salvador?
Well, my instinct would be that it be minimal, that within the Western Hemisphere that we promote a good neighbor policy, and that there not be justification for American military forces to dominate, something very different in our hemisphere contrasted with the kinds of problems that we face in the Middle East, for example.
I'd like to invite our listeners to call and speak with my guest, U.S. Senator Arlen Specter. Our number is area code 215-923-2774. And we're inviting you to call and make your suggestions as to how you think Senator Specter can best represent our state and national interests, and he will respond to your questions and to your suggestions. Again, we're at area code 215, and the number is 923-2774. The phones are now open. There's been some suggestion that Central America might become the next Vietnam. What do you think of that? How would you respond to that?
I do not see that as happening there. I think that we have had a lot of experience with Vietnam, and we are not going to get ourselves into another situation like that.
Okay. We have time for another question before we get to the phone calls. What do you think our energy policy should be? Do you think that the United States should be continuing to pursue nuclear energy? Do you think we should be investing much in that, or...
I think that we need an energy policy which is going to move in many directions at the same time. I think that coal is number one as an alternative source to oil and OPEC oil. I think we have to develop our own oil resources to the maximum extent possible. I believe in scientific development in solar energy and in synthetic fuels. I think we have to be sure that nuclear energy is safe as a condition for the development of nuclear energy. But according to the current timetables and drawing boards, nuclear energy does have a rather prominent part on an overall energy policy, occupying some 12% of our projected energy resources. But I think with the experience of Three Mile Island, that we have to be sure that it is safe.
Okay, let's take some phone calls now. My guest is U.S. Senator Arlen Specter. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to know whether the senator would be in favor of blocking military aid to El Salvador. And I'm also curious what his general view of the balance of power in El Salvador is right now.
I do not have a fixed opinion on the issue of where we ought to be in El Salvador. That is one of the subjects that I am taking a look at with a great many efforts. I might say that I do not come to the United State Senate full-blown as an expert on all the subject matters, and the whole area of foreign policy, when you start dealing with the specifics of El Salvador, is something that I'm reserving judgment on.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for calling. Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to know what the senator's position was on the full deregulation of the petroleum prices, and specifically, he stated that one of his priorities was inflation. And in light of what some of the oil companies have done in the past, I'm thinking particularly of Mobil Oil's purchase of Montgomery Ward, whether or not there is any real knowledge that this deregulation per se is going to massively increase oil reserves.
I have been very concerned about the sharp increase in gasoline prices which have followed from the deregulation of oil. I have observed that in my own service station, gas prices are up 12 cents in the intervening 2 weeks, and my brother tells me in Kansas that the prices are up 11 cents. And I am looking for a justification as to why that big jump so suddenly. The Energy Department had estimated that the cost would increase some 3 to 5 cents a gallon, and I know of no justification for that kind of an increase with the deregulation over such a short period of time. I did not vote on deregulation because that matter was before the Congress, long before I got there. I did express in my campaign a position in favor of the windfall profits tax because the oil companies have had so much by way of profits, which have resulted since the OPEC embargo going back to December of 1973. I think that if there is a clear relationship between the profits and plowbacks into exploration, that that may be a ground for giving tax beneficial tax treatment to those who will invest with the specifics of the money going right into developmental exploration. But I am concerned, and said so during the campaign, with the collateral investments of the illustration of Montgomery Ward and others where the oil companies are diversifying. I think that a company has a right to diversify, but if a company is going to take advantage of deregulation and have these large oil profits, then I think that those funds ought to be going into exploration specifically if they're to be accorded those profits.
Does that answer your question?
Basically, thank you.
Thank you for calling. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to comment on what the senator said about people making comments about the winnability of nuclear war. And I believe that Vice President Bush made a comment a little bit ago about the winnability of a nuclear war and that we want to be on the side that would win such a conflict. And I was wondering what he thinks of that.
I don't recall Vice President Bush making a statement about the winnability of a nuclear war. What I have heard, and I haven't seen a statement one way or another by him, the experts whom I have heard on the subject are in general agreement that there are no winners in a nuclear war. It is a matter of who loses the least.
Okay. I just wanted to also to share with you an anecdote. My daughter had an enrichment class which asked them to plot their lifeline, and we happened to go in and see it, and almost every single child had put somewhere within their lifespan World War III. And I don't know, I just expressed a very sad commentary to me on the way we're going, and I just hope that we're able to, you know, turn our direction around. Okay?
Well, I would like to be just a little more optimistic on that note. I can recall as a 15-year-old today, they dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and I recall tremendous tension personally and in the nation in 1945, 6, 7, 8, and 9 with the statement that the atomic age was here to stay, but the question is, are we? And we have, since 1945, over the course of the past however many years it is, 35, 36 years, come to an accommodation where the major powers at least have been smart enough not to resort to atomic warfare then the hydrogen bomb or now nuclear warfare. But I do quite agree with you that it is something we really have to work on. But I'm optimistic that if there's enough effort which is directed along that line that we can live with the Soviets or we can live with the Chinese. I'm concerned about other nations getting nuclear weapons, but I think it's something that we have to solve for the interests of your daughter and the other youngsters who may see World War III or may be apprehensive about it. I'm sorry to hear that they are apprehensive, but I think we have a realistic chance of staying away from it.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. I think that, and our listener who just called, I think corroborates this, that a lot of people are fearful that there's a warlike feeling that's developing in the country. Do you sense that?
I don't think so. There was talk during the campaign that President Reagan was more inclined to use of military force than was President Carter. And I think that that concern was pretty well dispelled in the debate which they held a week before the campaign was over, and I think was significantly responsible for President Reagan's victory, because people were dispelled from that thought. President Reagan has come out in a rather strong statement about Soviet activity, but I do not believe that that those statements are promoting the likelihood of war. I think that when you deal with the Soviet Union, that it is better to be strong. And when they want, for example, our modern technology, and Vice President Bush did speak about this recently in an article published in one of the French magazines, that we ought not to be making that available to them. The Russians are very much in disregard of human rights and are very tough on Soviet Jewry, for example, and that we find that we get more from the Russians, and they are in Afghanistan, and they oughtn't to be in Afghanistan, and we get more from them if we're a little stronger. And there's a lot of argument about the grain embargo now as to whether it unduly hurts the farmers. So that my net feeling is that dealing with the Russians, the Soviet Union, from a position of strength is in our national interest and in the interest of human rights around the world, and does not really materially increase the likelihood of global war. I think that's an alternative which both the United States and the Soviet Union are not looking toward realistically.
Alexander Haig, who's the Secretary of State, comes to that position from a background in the military. What kind of Secretary of State do you think he will make?
I think he's going to be a very good Secretary of State. I have had occasion to get to know him somewhat over the course of the past 7-8 years. I do not know him well, but I know him somewhat. And he is a very impressive man. He is a man of tremendous ability. He is a man of tremendous knowledge. And I think he is a strong man, and I think he is a peaceful man. But I think he knows what has to be done. When you talk about the position of Secretary of State, you're dealing with a very, very tough job. And there are no easy answers to it. And I like having a guy like Alexander Haig in that position.
What is it that makes you confident having him there?
I like him there because he knows our NATO allies. He has experience in NATO. I visited NATO last year and went to a conference there and talked to the people there. And in order to deal with the Western European nations, you have to have knowledge and you have to have strength and a policy which is firm, and I think that Alexander Haig inspires confidence there. I believe he knows the people all around the world, so that when he sets up a State Department and he deals with X in Ankara and Y in Tunisia, if you asked Arlen Specter who those people were and how capable they were, I really wouldn't know. But Alexander Haig has been in the business for a long time. He's a very sensible fellow. You know, he's a Philadelphian. Grew up in Germantown and went to high school in Lower Marion. Not that that necessarily qualifies him for Secretary of State, but I think he's a capable man.
Okay, let's get back to our listeners who are waiting on the telephone. We do have one open line if you'd like to get through. If you've been having trouble, our area code is 215. The number is 923-2774.
Where's the open line? I don't see an open line.
There it is.
That's when we're talking on.
They hung up.
Oh, how about that? Okay.
Right. My guest is Senator Arlen Specter. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Thank you.
There went the line, by the way.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to say that so far I like everything that Mr. Senator Specter has said. I would like to know if he is going to be a strong supporter of the administration's economic policies, including tax cuts for business and individuals, and if he supports the Kemp-Roth bill.
I do favor tax cuts, and I do believe that we can have an immediate 10% tax cut and I think produce more revenue with a tax cut by getting a larger base and produce more net taxes. The last time there was a tax cut goes back to 1964 and 5 when John Kennedy was president, And the predictions were that the tax cut would result in a reduction in federal revenues, and exactly the opposite happened. There was an increase of federal revenues. And when you get the creep, the bracket creep, plus inflation, I think that a 10% cut would be a wise thing now. I am not committed to a 30% Kemp-Roth tax cut because I think we have to see how the first 10% goes, and we have to see what happens by way of the budget cuts. But I do believe there is great merit in supply-side economics and the philosophical base of Kemp-Roth, which is Judah Winetsky's book, The Way It Works, I think is sound economics. And that's a controversial question as to whether it's right or wrong. But I do believe that among the varieties of economic theories around, this is the most likely to be successful. And the ones which have been tried heretofore have not been successful.
Thank you. Can I ask one more thing? What about tax credits for tuition in colleges, for parents of college children?
Well, my instinct is to be in favor of them for a number of reasons. I think that middle America has an enormous burden on educating their college-age children. I am anxious to see what the statistics look like in terms of what it costs in a matter of balancing out the overall cost factor. But I have two college students, two young sons in my own house, and everybody I talk to has enormous problems paying the tuition bills.
Yes, well, thank you very much.
Thanks for your questions. Bye-bye now. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, Terry, thank you. Senator, it's an honor to speak with you.
Nice talking to you.
I have a question concerning this beautiful state that we live in, because the last time we developed our coal resources, we didn't do the finest job of preserving the way the state looks. And given the president's statements concerning the environment and the fact that we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know, we can't stop developing things just to save the environment, I'm kind of concerned that the next time that we come around to develop the coal resources of the state and provide all the jobs and all the things that that would be positive, we're going to leave behind what we left behind the last time.
Well, I think that the studies show that we can develop Pennsylvania coal consistent with a clean environment. There was a study which was concluded about 11 months ago, which was a $10 billion program for the development of coal in the United States, and it had added on to it $1 billion for environmental concerns with the scrubbers and the preservation of the environment. And it satisfied the toughest environmental groups, and still the price of coal came out way below the price of OPEC oil. So that I think, given the high cost of oil, it is possible to develop Pennsylvania coal consistent with the environmental protection.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. Apropos the discussions of energy, in this, you were mentioning before that you were thinking about looking closely at the oil companies' use of their newfound wealth. What about the general reexamination of their tax situation? Mainly, apparently, from what I understand, that many of their foreign oil prices are technically considered taxes, and as such are able to be deducted as a tax credit. So in effect, they get oil cheaper from foreign countries than they do here, and in fact, in many countries, a good portion of the price that they pay is considered the tax. So, in effect, the rest of the taxpayers are sort of underwriting the cost of their raw material. And that in these methods of economic development, that we have a sense not certainly of the natural environment, but also of the financial environment, so that we try and have a set goal of what is best for our country, both financially as well as environmentally and socially, et cetera.
Okay, does that do it?
That basically,
if you can wrap up that question.
Yeah. All right.
I'm going to ask Terry to restate your question in just a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was running on. But basically, that it seems that we have a tax law that encourages oil companies to go outside the United States, which is not good for the United States, to get oil. and there's all this fuss about it. Are we going to do anything to change the law so that it is in the United States' best interest? That's it.
Well, I know that the issue of the foreign tax credit is a very controversial one, and I do not know the answer to it. I think it is desirable for American oil companies to be developing oil all over the world to the extent that they can make those supplies available to the United States and hopefully without having the OPEC countries dictate what those prices are. But I have heard complaints about the foreign tax credit, and that's something that I am interested in finding out about.
Because in effect, the cost of their oil, since they are making such enormous profit, can write off their taxes.
Well, it does work out somehow that you get a foreign investment tax credit, and it is not subject to the regular provisions of the windfall profits tax.
Right.
And that is an item which is of concern to me.
It seems like a gigantic loophole encouraging getting oil from overseas.
Well, I frankly...
It's cheaper than over there.
I do not understand all of the ramifications of it. And that is one item which I want to find out about. One thing I've found, I've been a senator now for 5 weeks and a day, so I've had a lot of experience, but it is, I say that only jokingly, it is just a massive proposition. And the subject that you bring up, I've heard a fair amount of talk about that, and I do believe that the Finance Committee of the Senate is going to take on that question. I have heard discussion. Senator Dole is the chairman of that committee, and our very able Senator John Hines from Pennsylvania is on that committee. You might be interested to know that two senators from the same state cannot be on the same committee, and I think that Pennsylvania is fortunate in that Senator Hines is on finance and I am on appropriations, which are considered to be the two most important committees as they affect domestic policy. The other committees, which are considered important, are the top four committees are Foreign Relations and Armed Services, and while they're very important, they don't have quite the impact on day in and day out lives unless you get to the nuclear war issue. But I know that the Finance Committee is going to take up that issue.
Okay, thank you very much for your phone call. Okay, bye-bye. If you're just joining us, my guest is Senator Arlen Specter, and we're inviting your phone calls at 923-2774. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
It seems to me that a measure of the ignorance of legislators who have gone before you, from Pennsylvania especially, is shown by the fact that Philadelphia is surrounded by nuclear reactors. Today we heard that Three Mile Island was, what they're really saying, I believe, is that Three Mile Island is worse than they thought and that it's a goddamn good thing that it had a strong containment vessel. The second thing is at Oyster Creek today, there was a spillage of radioactive water inside the building. In the third place, I happen to know that Peach Bottom has had a lot of problems, operational problems. Do you have any ideas for cleaning up the mess near Harrisburg and for getting rid of the radioactive wastes once they've been so-called cleaned up?
I do not know any more than I have seen from the reports of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and those coming out of Three Mile Island, and I agree with your tone that there are a lot of unanswered questions about TMI at the present time. I think that it is unfair that the residents of that area would be affected by rate increases for what has happened in TMI, where there has been suggestions that that the companies be able to pass on those tremendous costs, which resulted significantly from their own negligence, as the preliminary reports have indicated. I think you have two big issues. One is the issue of safety, so that we learn from TMI. What it is to operate that kind of an installation safely. And the second issue arises as to who's going to pay for it. And I think that the best idea that I have seen is the one which would distribute the costs among all nuclear energy users across the country on an insurance principle, so that there be a small cost added on to everybody around the country who uses nuclear energy and an insurance fund be perpetuated for these kinds of problems. I'm frankly reluctant to see the federal government step in there to bail out TMI, but I think the most fundamental concern is that those users themselves certainly cannot be have their rates bear those kinds of rehabilitation
costs. Well, could you address the issue I asked you about, this cleaning up the waste safely?
I did address that issue.
No, you're talking about money. I'm talking about radioactive waste.
Well, I told you at the start that as to the safety factor, the most I know is what I've read in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission reports. I am not an expert, nor have I been there, nor am I competent to comment beyond what the experts have said.
Also, within the last night or two, they carried highly radioactive wastes across the state. Can this be done safely on public roads? Can it be done safely at all?
I don't know the answer to that.
Frankly, I haven't felt well for the last day or two, and I think it's due to the radioactivity around.
Thank you very much for your phone call. This might be a good time to ask you to briefly reiterate your policy, your stand on nuclear power, whether you think it should be pursued or slowed down until more is known about how to safely dispose of nuclear waste.
I think that we have to be sure that it can be operated safely. And I think that the TMI experience is one that we have to profit by.
Well, how can we profit by that?
Well,
I think our phone caller was obviously very upset by feeling vulnerable to the nuclear waste caused by
well,
the accident.
There are a lot of unanswered questions which arise from TMI. One question is on the construction of those installations. Were there safe welds? Were there shortcuts? Were there equipment economies which simply subjected people in that area to too much by way of risk? Now, it is very heavily dramatized as to what the consequences can be. And now everybody is on guard that you've got to have proper construction procedures, and there have to be tests, and there has to be a very tight governmental regulation. At a time when you talk about lesser governmental regulation, this is one field where we are not going to be able to rely upon private industry, but there's going to have to be a tight federal policy. All right, that's one thing on construction. A second issue which has come very sharply into focus has been the issue of wastes, nuclear wastes. And I've read a lot of the materials on that subject, and I do not know the answer to how you dispose of nuclear waste. And if you can't find an answer to that, then there's a sharp limitation as to what you can do on the development of nuclear energy. Now, those are a couple of just very basic safety factors which come ahead of the question of cost. You don't get the cost until you satisfy safety.
So to sum up, is your policy proceed but proceed with caution with nuclear power? Or?
I would say so. I would say that we ought to be proceeding full speed ahead on the answers to the TMI kind of problem and the disposal of nuclear waste to find out ways to make a determination if it is possible to have nuclear energy which is safe.
Okay. If the nuclear waste problem is not resolved in the near future at TMI, what kind of action do you think should be taken?
I think that depends upon what we find. It depends upon what the Nuclear Regulatory Agency finds. And I think that is something which the Congress and the Senate's going to have to keep a close eye, because there is a tremendous public concern here. And one of the duties of a senator, a congressman, is an oversight duty on federal agencies.
Okay, let's return to the phones now. My guest is Senator Arlen Specter. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to ask the senator a question concerning his position on mass public transportation. It's of concern to me that President Reagan has proposed this area as one subject to some budget cuts. And as a rider of the SEPTA system, I feel, and if my information is correct, we're paying probably the highest fares in the nation for probably what is the worst public transportation service in the nation. So it seems obvious to me that a public transportation system cannot exist on local funding alone. Therefore, I'd like to know that when he has the opportunity to vote on this particular item, how he plans to vote, and if he plans on siding with the president in this matter, what alternatives would he propose for the viable development of public transportation?
I do not believe that President Reagan has yet taken a position on the budget cuts generally or on mass transit specifically.
Okay, well, this is something that I have heard then from his spokespersons.
Well, David Stockman has issued some preliminary findings, but I saw nothing. I was briefed by...
I believe that Drew Lewis has also referred to cutting back on funds for urban mass transportation.
Well, I have not seen anything that Drew Lewis has said on that subject.
How about if we hypothesize that this is in front of you? I'd still like to know.
Well, my sense, as I said earlier, is that that mass transits ought not to be cut. That's one of the areas which requires a very considerable governmental help. I think we do have a bad transit system in this city because of the lack of funding. I do not believe it is accurate that our fares are the highest in the country, however. I think this is a problem you find everywhere. You find this problem in New York City. You find it everywhere in Washington. Let me tell you, Washington's got a great mass transit system. Really is a model. And there's no reason why we couldn't duplicate that in other cities. And I think when you come to the so-called infrastructure on transit, And this goes beyond SEPTA, this goes to Conrail, and this goes to Amtrak. This is one of the really traditional areas where government should be helping out.
Okay, does that answer your question then?
Yes, it does.
Okay, thanks so much for your call.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Why, I'm quite concerned that I hear many people in the government these days speaking about government spending being so inflationary, and although I know that that is true, I can't understand why we don't also hear that the high cost of energy, every time oil goes up, it goes right through the entire economy, that that's very inflationary, and probably the most inflationary item of all is our large defense budget, and related to that, I wonder when we're going to expect Europe and Japan to carry a little more of their own defense.
Well, I think that you are right that inflation comes from many causes, and we do pay a high price on this deregulation of oil, the way it has already caused gas prices to go up, and there's a calculation that it is necessary in the long run to provide capital for development. And I think that's something that has to be very closely monitored, and that ties back in with the windfall profits tax. When you talk about defense spending, of course it's inflationary, no doubt about that. The statistics show that we have been spending a smaller share of our gross national product on defense than we have on other items, and when we have an experience like we did in Iran, and we try to send a small tactical force for a rescue mission, we suddenly find out what the capabilities are of this country militarily, and Iran is a very, very rude awakening, and that led to disclosures about the number of divisions which are not combat ready, so that I believe that from a moderate point of view, that the people in this country are now of a mind that there has to be added strength. But we're not going to go off the deep end and spend all our money on defense as opposed to other items. I do not have any ready answer for you. All I can say to you is that I'm taking a look at it from the Appropriations Committee, which has all of these matters before it. And it is a tough balancing job to take a look at a budget. After all, we spend $650 billion a year. Next year's budget is even more than that. If you talk about a $40 billion cut, that's a lot of money, but it is a relatively small percent. But still, it is hard to find where to cut those funds. And that's the job that the Congress has. But I cannot give you any formulas to how much is going to be allocated to mass transit, what is going to happen on defense, how does it interact with a budget, with a tax cut on increasing incentives. It is a very complex picture, but I think it is plain that the problem of inflation is of such a magnitude that unless we make inroads on that, nothing is going to be worth anything.
Well, I understand that, but I really wanted to hear somebody bring in these other factors?
Well, I think it's important to consider them as you have enumerated them.
Thank you for your phone call. Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Thank you. Senator, I would like to know whether you would support the proposal for the National Academy of Peace and Conflict Resolution.
You'll have to tell me what that academy is. I'm not familiar with it.
Well, it's a proposal to establish an academy to study peacemaking and how to resolve conflicts other than by war. The Congress gave a small amount of money, really, a couple of years ago to study this proposal, and the report was due back to Congress in December. Now, I don't know who of these senators and representatives are still in office in Washington, but a lot of people are certainly interested in something like that, after all.
Well, I would want to take a look at it before saying anything definite,
right.
but I can tell you it's going to be a tough atmosphere to get new matters through funding if they aren't related to something which is very close to bread and butter. Very hard.
There's an awful lot of money being spent for defense and learning how to wage war. It seems that spending some money for schooling for peace makes a lot of sense.
Well, I think there's a good point there. I'll be anxious to see the report. When you mentioned the academy, as I said to you candidly, I had not heard of it.
It was a proposal to establish an academy.
Uh-huh. And has there some funding already been allocated, or just in the study stage?
It was $500,000 in 1978, and the final report was to go to Congress in December of 1980.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up, you know, I'm sure it's somewhere in the middle of everything that Congress is going to have to.
Well, I've made a note of it, and I will take a look.
Okay, we look to hear from you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your phone call. Bye-bye. We're at 923-2774. My guest is Senator Arlen Specter. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, Senator Specter, I'd like to know your views on the legalization or decriminalization of marijuana.
I am opposed to legalization and decriminalization of marijuana.
Why specifically?
Because I think the balance of medical authority is that marijuana is very harmful. I do not believe that people ought to go to jail for use of marijuana, however, and as District Attorney of Philadelphia back in 1971, I put that policy into effect, that when you're dealing with marijuana users, I started a program which was called pre-indictment probation in 1971 when Terry was in grade school, and is now called ARD, so that I do not believe in a jail sentence, but I for users, for sellers or pushers, it's another matter. But I do believe that it is sufficiently harmful, according to the existing medical reports, that it is not wise to legalize it.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your phone call. You don't think it's wise to decriminalize it, are you?
Correct.
Okay. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yeah, I would just like to ask the senator, in light of his professed respect for Secretary of State Alexander Haig, whether or not he feels that the policy of de-emphasizing human rights in favor of concern for international terrorism is wise. And I'm specifically directing the question on few significant factors. First of all, basically everyone's against international terrorism, but historically and currently, authoritarian regimes generally, Latin America specifically, but around the world, use the fight against terrorism as almost a code word to repress and to engage in rather massive violations of human rights. Secondly, in light of the publicity of NPR and other media, there seem to be a certain amount of comfort in regimes which have historically violated human rights, and the idea that, well, if it's a policy of the United States government to de-emphasize human rights, then we have carte blanche to do whatever we want. And thirdly, I'm just worried about, in terms of past history, I mean, the hostages have just returned from Iran, and we're now at the point of deciding whether or not we're going to get involved or further involved in El Salvador. And when you have the idea that human rights really isn't very important, I'm just wondering if he feels that it's a wise decision, a wise course to take.
I do not think it is a wise course to de-emphasize human rights. and to articulate a principle which says our number one priority is to be anti-terrorism as opposed to elevating human rights. I think that both of those are very important goals. Given my own preference, I would elevate human rights in contrast to the issue of terrorism. Or perhaps I would say that both of them are very fundamental goals, and we are not going to tolerate terrorism, and we are going to do our utmost on the issue of human rights. Now, I do not know why Secretary of State Haig made the statement which he did, and perhaps I will have a chance to ask him about that. He met with a group of us about 10 days ago and had a very interesting discussion for about 2 hours and explored quite a number of subjects. That was not one of them, so I may have an opportunity to put that question to him. I think you reach a much tougher question when you come into a specific country, and I do not have one in mind, where we are not satisfied with a regime in a foreign country in terms of the way that particular government is recognizing human rights. And then the question is, what do we do about it? Do we oppose that government? I mean, is it our business to go in and seed unrest to overthrow a government because that government is not satisfying us in terms of their recognition of human rights? Now, I don't think it is. I think that we get into more trouble than we solve problems if we start taking it upon ourselves to make judgments, and then we have people in the State Department and CIA making judgments around the world, which I don't think ought to be made. It's a very tough line, but simply to. I think Terry wants me to wind this answer.
No, I just wanted to say that I've heard the fear expressed not that we'd overthrow governments who are suppressing human rights, but rather in some instances we might find that we're supporting governments who are violating human rights.
Well, I think that when we get involved in making changes in internal affairs of governments in far distant places, we start dealing with very, very difficult problems, very, very difficult concepts. But I would say That on the rhetorical level, in terms of the rhetoric, it is preferable not to say we're going to devalue human rights. I think that was an unfortunate thing to be said. It may be that we cannot do as much as we'd like to in a specific situation because of complicated factors.
Do you see any instances around the globe where you feel that United States support is being given to a government that is responsible for human rights violations?
Terry, I'm not prepared to say. I just really, really do not know.
Okay. Thank you very much for your phone call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. I'm afraid we won't have any time for further phone calls. We've just got a few remaining seconds. And the question I'd like to end with is, how do you think Pennsylvania can best take advantage of the Republican gains, you being a Republican, in the legislature now?
I think that with Dick Schweiker, the former senator whose seat I took as Secretary of Health and Human Services, he's a good man, and I think that he'll have a special interest in his own state while giving due regard to the rest of the country. And Drew Lewis from Montgomery County, as Secretary of Transportation, I think Drew will be especially sympathetic to the problems of Pennsylvania's transportation. And in Alexander Haig, we can have our own foreign policy if we want one for our state. And I think Senator Hines has done a very good job in his 4 years of his six-year term, coming there after 5 years in the Congress, and I am going to be working very hard at my new responsibilities so that I think that with as many Republicans as we have, with President Reagan in the White House, that we have a good chance to do good work for Pennsylvania, and we're going to try.
Senator Arlen Specter, I thank you very much for speaking with us, and I invite you to come back and talk with us again soon here in Fresh Air. I hope you can visit with us again.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to say that Senator Arlen Specter will also hold an open house tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. in his office on Arch Street. That's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. I thank all of you for your phone calls. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Noah Adams.
And I'm Sanford Unger, with All Things Considered.
Mr. Thompson, the show hero! CIA must go! Mr. Thompson, the show hero! CIA must go! Mr. Thompson! Victor Tomseth, one of the American hostages held in Iran for 14 months, went back to his alma mater last night, the University of Oregon. The story tonight on All Things Considered about a welcome that was not warm.
Also tonight, these stories. President Reagan says that 7 federal programs are sacred and will not be cut. They affect the old, the young, and the disabled.
The president's economic advisors are out on the luncheon lecture circuit explaining what will be needed in hard times.
Budget Director David Stockman may himself have trouble on Capitol Hill.
Another change of prime ministers in Poland.
Farmers there may be able to form an association, but not a union.
In Houston, an epidemic of meningitis in the schools.
And starting a literary magazine, it's not all that difficult.
Talking.